My name is Carol Parsonage. Today, Monday, December 8th, 2008, at 10:30 a.m., I am interviewing Dr. Douglas Bonnell at his home in Georgetown. This interview will become part of the Georgetown Library's Oral History Collection. This particular project focuses on people's memories of Carver and Marshall schools and the issues and events of the 1950s and 1960s that led to desegregation. Dr. Bonnell, thank you for being an interview subject for this project.
Glad to do it.
I'd like to ask you, when did you come to Georgetown? How long have you lived in Georgetown?
Well, I've been here a long time. My family moved here in 1934 when I was in the sixth grade, starting the sixth grade.
Okay. Well, in those early years, in those childhood years, tell me what kind of interaction you had with blacks and African Americans in Georgetown.
Well, in the early years, in the sixth grade, that was the old Annie Pearl School, which is no longer here. That was down on Austin Avenue and University Avenue corner. Of course, we were not integrated at that time, so I saw very little of the African American kids at that time.
Did you see them in the community?
Oh, sure. We'd go to town, and they'd be on the square and in the movies and so forth. Of course, the black people had to sit in the balcony. Then in high school, I had more interaction with them because they used there was a football field behind the old high school, which is now the Williams Elementary. Mm-hmm. There on University Avenue. The football field behind there is where we practiced our football team, and colored school used that for their football games. So being interested in athletics and all, well, I was out there for their games and mixed in and knew some of the kids that way.
Okay. Well, what was an African-American school football game like? Was it different from the white schools?
No, it wasn't, except that I remember the band leader or the drum major of the band was a great big tall male boy. And usually, you know, in those times, our drum majors and twirlers were all girls. But I remember one, he was very flamboyant, and the cheering was a little bit more enthusiastic. And really, they really got with it and boosted their team. And a little bit more spirit and enthusiasm than the white kids. We had our cheerleaders and all, but they were a little more traditional and subdued. But boy, the colored football games were really it was really something. Then they had some great athletes too, and of course I got to know them and had some. But otherwise, socially, there was really nothing at that time when I was in school. Of course, that was in the 30s, the late 30s. I graduated in 1940.
Okay. And then, did you go to college here at Southwestern?
Yes, I did.
And off to medical school?
Well, I went to college until 43, and then we were in the war.
Oh, right.
And I was called to active duty in 43 to go into the Army and basic training and so forth. Okay. And then after basic training, we were out in the field. We were fixing to ship out. I guess we were heading toward Europe, but anyway, fellas came out in the field and made an announcement. Any of you fellas have admittance to medical school or dental school? And I did. I'd already been accepted to Baylor Med School and had completed 3 years of pre-med. So I got pulled out and sent to med school. And I actually was still in med school when the war was over.
Okay. And then you came back here to practice.
Came back after internship and residency and so forth. I came back here, and Nell and I moved back here in 1950.
And you opened an office here?
I opened an office in the back of a little drugstore called City Drug on the east side of the square, and that's where the Cianfrani's coffee shop was for a while. Now, okay. They've moved over to the north side of the square, and that right. building is vacant now.
Right.
But that had been a doctor's office, the back of that drugstore, for many, many years. In fact, in those times, most of the doctors had offices in the back of the drugstore.
Oh, that's an interesting
yeah.
piece of information.
They'd furnish, the drugstore would furnish a little office there and hopefully get the prescriptions from the patients that came out.
Sure.
But that was my situation there. But, of course, then in 1952, the Korean War was going on, and I was in the Air Force Reserve.
Okay.
And I got called to active duty during the Korean War and stationed in San Antonio. And I thought, well, you know, I'll be here for the duration. I was married and had two children and so forth. But in September of 52, I got transferred to a wing that was going to Korea, and, mm-hmm. and I had done quite a bit of surgery, and I was a surgeon in that wing and sent to Korea in the fall of 52.
And you came back then?
Came back to Georgetown in 54.
Okay, okay.
And that's been here
ever since.
Yeah.
Well, your patients as the doctor here in Georgetown, I understand there weren't very many doctors in Georgetown.
Well, actually, there were. When I came here, believe it or not, there were seven doctors.
Wow.
For just about 4,000 or 5,000 people. And, of course, we drew from Florence and Gerald and mm-hmm. this end of the county. But one of the doctors was elderly and about to retire, and the other one was very ill with cirrhosis of the liver and died in his 50s. And then one of the doctors decided to move. He divorced and moved to Arizona, and another one moved to West Texas. And by the latter part of the 1950s, Dr. Getty and I and another doctor, Dr. Cooper, were really the only active doctors in Georgetown. So we suddenly went from seven down to three, and Dr. Cooper was really not very active. Dr. Getty and I became partners in 57 when I bought, it was a private hospital at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So I bought half interest in the hospital, and we combined and built a new clinic there just east of the old hospital. That's where
now,
the Georgetown
where
Community
that?
Clinic is.
Okay.
It's
okay.
700 block of University, West okay. East University. But anyway, we became partners and built that clinic at the same time, and that was in 58.
Well, I'd like to ask about your patients. Did you treat African-American patients?
Oh, sure. We treated everybody.
And were there any things you had to do differently in treating African-American patients?
I didn't. We didn't have any. I never had a separate waiting room or anything like that. And I didn't give preference to anybody. First come, first serve.
Right.
And in those days, I didn't really make appointments. You go to the doctor and you first, the one's there. And a lot of times I had the waiting room just full of people, and I didn't give any preference.
Okay.
Who they were, first in line, got in first. But then, of course, we had, if the president of Southwestern decided that he needed to have something done, well, I'd slip him in the back door or something like that.
Right.
But in general, the African-Americans were not treated any different than anybody else.
Okay.
Of course, in those early days when I was, before I bought into the hospital, I did quite a bit of home deliveries simply okay. because they couldn't afford the hospital and certainly couldn't pay me anything and still pay the hospital. So I did a lot of home deliveries out on the what we call the ridge, which is the west part of town along the South San Gabriel River.
Okay. So you were in, that was the African-American community.
Yes.
you were in that community then on a fairly regular basis?
Oh, I made house calls out there. Besides deliveries, I'd occasionally make house calls out there.
Can you describe that area, what that looked like?
Well, in the 50s, it was very, very poor. A lot of outdoor toilets and the houses were not nice. We had two or three or four African-American families that were a little upper-scale homes. Some worked for people in town and some worked at Southwestern and were really, I think, above average intellectually and education-wise to the average black citizens.
At that time, yeah.
But I spent quite a bit of time out there.
Well, did they have stores and things like that in that area?
Not much.
Not much. They
had a little black cafe out there, but I don't think they had any businesses of their own.
And you said you saw African Americans on the square regularly.
Oh, sure. They shopped in the same stores as everybody else did.
Okay.
The only thing is at the movies, they had to sit in the balcony and, of course, this ridiculous stuff like separate water fountains and
Right. What about streets and things like that? Were they paved?
Some were, but a lot of the streets, especially in the ridge area or the African-American area, a lot of them were gravel in the early days. And in San Jose, which was the Latin American area, also was most of those streets were gravel instead of paved. But that wasn't necessarily discriminating. A lot of the streets in the white part of town were gravel also. They weren't all asphalt.
that time. Okay. I'd like to move forward to the periods of time you spent on the school board. You were on the school board two different times, is
that
right?
Two different times, right.
And the first one began?
1955.
And how did that come about? Did you run for the school board?
No. J.J. Jones, who had been on the school board a while, for some reason had to drop out. And some of the members of the board just came to me and asked me if I would fill in, and I was appointed to take his place to finish out his term.
Okay.
And then, I forget if there was a year left on it or what, but anyway, I ran for re-election after that and stayed on the board 5 years.
Okay, so until 1960?
Till 60.
Okay.
And that's, of course, that's when the problem of integration really started.
In that
really
period
started.
Of time, integration must have been a major topic for the
Well,
board.
It was. Not so major until about the early 60s, but in 54, as you'll recall, the Supreme Court ruled that this doctrine of separate but equal was a lot of baloney, and it was. It was no such thing as separate but equal. Our black school was a disgrace. And in fact, we were about to lose our accreditation for our whole school district because of the deplorable condition of the black school. And so soon after I got on the board, we started talking about the fact that, you know, legally, according to the Supreme Court, we ought to be integrated. Mm-hmm. But there were a lot of so-called states' writers that didn't believe, you know, that this ought to be a decision for the state to make rather than the national Supreme Court. So there was a lot of resistance to that, and nobody really thought, well, you know, they say that, but we don't have to do it. But we started talking about it, and the problems involved if we did start talking about integration and about who would we hire, and, you know, would the black teachers be hired, and all the things like that, and the property, would we build a new black school, or would we, because theirs was in more need than we needed more room for the white students, and the fact that we needed more room, period, was the thing that really it made sense for the people that wanted to integrate, because we figure to build a separate black school and just flaunt the Supreme Court didn't really make sense. And besides that, if we needed to increase our own school capability, like a new junior high or a new high school, and build a black school, it would just wasn't economically feasible. The cheapest way to go and obey the law at the same time was to add a junior high or a high school and integrate at the same time. Then we didn't have to build a black school. So, but there was the school board at the time was pretty segregationist, and they were willing to give up the financial advantage just to stay segregated.
And so did any building occur in that time of your first term?
No.
A lot of discussion, but no.
A lot of discussion. And we had actually, to go back to that time, the problem was that we couldn't afford to build anything, because there was a law that says you cannot borrow money more than 10% of your evaluation. Well, our whole evaluation for the whole school district wasn't but $6 million. Mm-hmm. And we were already in debt $480,000. So even if we passed a bond issue and decided to build a school, all we had was $120,000. And you really couldn't build anything for that. So our problem when I was on the board the first time, we had to reevaluate our school district property. And that's when it really hit the fan, because a lot of people were, when the reevaluation took place, their taxes would double, because some of them hadn't had their property reevaluated since the Depression days. And here they were paying very little tax. And if you say their property is worth twice as much now, which it was.
Right.
And that's when the argument came in, because a lot of landowners were...
Now, did that happen in this time happened, that you were on the school
That
board?
Happened, right. We hired a land or property evaluation company and went in it with the city. The city needed to update their tax rolls too. So we hired them to reevaluate all the property. Well, now this was done about 1959 and 60. And that's, okay. We had hired this, and they were in the process of doing this when I went off the board. Reason I went off the board is that my father had died and my mother was ill. And my sister, who was single, was teaching down in the Houston area. Mm-hmm. And she wanted to come up and live in Georgetown and help take care of my mother. But she wanted to teach. She was a teacher. So I had to resign from the school board before we could hire her as a teacher.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So that's why I went off the board.
Okay. Let me ask you a couple of things about the board. How big was it? How many people were on the board?
Gosh. Seven or eight
people. And were they elected, like, at large?
Mm-hmm.
They were at large.
At that time, yeah.
Okay. So you went off the board in 1960, and then you went...
Well, I was not on the board again until 67.
67. How active or involved were you in school issues in that interim period?
I would say I was semi-active. Early on, after I went off the board, I went to this, when this integration crisis started, I went to the board once and asked them to have a referendum on integration, let the people vote on it. And at that time, there was a state law saying that you had to have a list of people, in order to bring up a vote for integration, you had to have 20% of the electorate, or the people who were eligible to vote, had to sign a petition.
Okay.
Well, a lot of the preachers in town had been working for integration, and our preacher at First Methodist Church appeared to the school board right after I had asked them to bring this up, and they said, yeah, it's okay with us if you want to vote on it. Well, we came up with this petition, and then the school board was different. We had some of the people who were really pinched on this new land evaluation were on the board.
So there'd been an election in that
period. There'd been an election, and they voted the petition down because it was some technicality that the people, some of the names are on the back side of the paper or something. It was in the school board minutes about how they turned it down. But anyway, when it was obvious that the school board was dead set against integration, that's then when Committee for Better Schools was organized, started by Southwestern professors mostly, and preachers, and a couple of other people in town went together and brought suit to prevent them from building a black school, since the Supreme Court had already ruled it illegal and so forth. And that's, I was semi-active in that, but right at that time I was awfully busy with just two doctors covering the emergency room and a lot of factors. But I did, I was not on the Committee for Better Schools that brought this suit, but I did donate money so that they could hire a lawyer to state their case and
okay,
so forth.
Okay. Well, I understand that you also canvassed the African-American community to see.
Yes. Our newspaper was definitely segregationist, as were a lot of other people in
sure.
town. A lot of good people. They just had that problem.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, one of the editorials about 1961, I believe.
Okay.
Came out and said that he did not believe that most of the African Americans wanted to integrate. They wanted to keep their own school. And I didn't believe this. And I had black people working at the hospital for me and in the clinic, and I was on that side of town all the time making house calls and delivering babies, and I knew the people pretty well, and I thought most of them wanted to integrate because they wanted their kids to have a decent education. So I worked together with Bertie Shanklin and a couple of other black nurses and employees of the hospital, and did a thorough canvass of every black family on the ridge, and came up 85% of the people said they wanted to integrate. And we had asked them the question, would you be willing to put your child back a grade if the schooling they had received is not quite up to snuff? And
mm-hmm.
they said that's okay. But some of them wanted to keep their own school because they knew that if we integrated, that they were not going to have black coaches and black teachers. I mean, we weren't that far along.
Mm-hmm.
And I think legitimately they would prefer to have their own school. On the other hand, 85% wanted to integrate just so their kids could get a better education and have better facilities and so forth. I took this to the editor of the local paper, and he wouldn't publish it. And I was disappointed, but I could see his viewpoint because, and I know that he was against integration.
Right.
But I think what really drove it was economics, because two of his biggest advertisers in the local paper were strong segregationists. And I think that he didn't want to offend those. I mean, it was his, it was an economic thing, I feel like. Now, that's just my opinion.
Did you think other people in Georgetown had, other of the white community had similar problems? They were concerned about, you know, their customer base or things like that, if in fact they, I mean, was that an issue that kept?
I don't know about that, but I do know that one of the members of the Committee for Better Schools who ran a laundry here lost an awful lot of business because the fact that he stood with the integration people.
Okay. You made a comment earlier about there had been a school board election and the school board had changed to a group of people who actually were more concerned about this increase in property values as opposed to being segregationists, or were they a
combination? I think it was a mixture. I think it was a mixture. There was, when this new property evaluation came through, some of the biggest property owners were really hit pretty hard, and they came to the school board and protested. And this, I think, was, in hindsight, was a mistake, because the superintendent and the chairman of the school board at that time said, we cannot reverse the findings of this evaluation board that we hired. They've given us the information. We don't think that the school board can change that, and made a lot of people very angry. Because they would not only they raise their taxes, but they wouldn't listen to their appeal to talk it over and do something a little more of a compromise. The school board just said, and the superintendent said, "Nope, that's it." And hard feelings that started at that time ended up firing the superintendent of schools a year or so later when these people got on the board.
So they maybe did actually run for school board because of the property issue.
I think that was part of it, but it just so happened that these same people were
also
were against integration.
Okay.
Now one of the people who came onto the board said that he was not against integration, but he just wanted it to be 1 year at a time. And I think that was some other people probably thought that that might be the easiest way to do it too. But it was a combination of.
Did Georgetown actually attempt to do 1 year at a time for a while?
It wasn't in 64 we started. I mean, the courts ruled that we did need to integrate. But they did accept a gradual type integration. Now, the exact how many grades here and how many grades there, I'm not real sure. I don't remember that well. But for a short time, see, the school board went ahead and built the West Side School, which had they intended it to be a black school.
And it's now.
But well, it's the West Side Elementary. It's Carver.
Carver Elementary now.
But actually, the integration had progressed, so it was not a black school. It was officially it was integrated, but certain grades. So we had some black teachers out there, and they were given the choice of going there to the black school or to come to the white school. But most of the blacks went to that school.
Okay.
What we were.
Oh, I did too. I think we'll just go on to another question is what we'll do here.
Okay.
During this period that you were off the school board, were any, you mentioned the West Side School, that was built during that period?
Yes,
Were there other schools built during that period? No.
Not at that time. We built the junior high school soon after that, And that was the school that's out on Williams Drive.
Okay, McCoy.
McCoy, right.
Okay.
That came in just after the West Side School was built.
Okay. So there, in that period, after the taxes had been raised, they were able to build some schools.
Oh, yes. We, in fact, the valuation went from $6 million up to about $14 million when that reappraisal came through.
Okay.
So we did have the money available to build. And the school board at that time decided to build the West Side School and then the junior high.
Okay.
I know what I was forgetting a while ago. We were...
I need you to... Oh. It's hard to pick you up.
The thing that we started out integrating gradually.
Okay.
One or two grades here and one or two grades here. But then Lyndon Johnson passed his Civil Rights Act
right.
in 1965, I believe.
I think that's right.
And he...
Actually, 64, July of
64. Well, we had already started integration a little bit at a time. But Lyndon Johnson got that through, and he made the ruling that you will be totally integrated by 67, or else you won't get any more federal aid. So that settled that.
Okay.
I mean, the school board had sense enough to know, well, now is the time to,
right.
to fully integrate.
Enough of that.
So that's when it really totally happened.
Well, now, when did you go back on the school board?
I went back in 67.
And did you run for that?
Yes.
Okay. And stayed on?
I stayed on until 76.
Okay, almost 10 years.
On the board about 14 years total.
So 67, the schools would have been newly integrated the first year you were back on the school board.
Right.
How did that go?
Very well, I think. We had, Georgetown, we had people that were not for integration, but they were not bad people. They were good people, and they were law-abiding people, and they just didn't want the segregationists, except for the fact that they had this hang-up about going to school with the blacks, were good people. And we had a smooth, once it was the law and once the board voted
right.
to integrate, we didn't have a lot of trouble. Now, some of the black families thought that the coaches may not have treated the black players quite as nice as they did some of the white, and you heard little stories of that, but nothing. It was, all in all, I think, very smooth. We had, there was one incident that came up when, let's go back.
Okay.
Because of the reevaluation problems, our superintendent was not rehired.
Okay.
So he left, and the school board hired another superintendent. This is before I came on.
Okay.
And he stayed 2 or 3 years, and then another one came on. And when I got back on the board in 67, we had just hired our third superintendent. And at that time, our school finances were in terrible, terrible shape. I think our superintendent at the time had some real great ideas, but we were spending a lot more money than we were getting in. And we had a real financial crisis there for a while. We needed to build a new high school badly. But for 2 or 3 years, we just couldn't do it. And then when we hired a new superintendent, who was Jack Frost, and Jack stayed with us for a long time. And the idea, when we hired Jack, the thing we started out from the very beginning is we've got to get us a new high school built. Well, we were in such financial straits that took 2 or 3 years to get that through. But then we did. We finally did that. But what I was going to bring up about the smooth integration, soon after Jack got here as superintendent, we had an incident where a couple of the black boys skipped out of school for some minor incident. Yeah. And anyway, I don't know, they might have talked back to a teacher or something and then decided they better leave. I don't know what it was exactly, but it was not a major crime.
Right.
But anyway, superintendent kicked them out of school. And so we had a big school board meeting, and the NAACP heard about it, and they were there, and we had half the community there in the old high school auditorium listening in on this school board meeting when we were discussing the expelling of these boys. And but we had a nice session at that meeting, and the boys were questioned and asked if they really wanted an education, are they willing to abide by the rules, and so on and so forth. They said, yeah, they want it. They wanted to come to school, and they wanted to get educated. And the school board reversed that expulsion and reinstated them. And I think this was a real good move.
Mm-hmm.
That we did at that time, and kind of set the stage that, you know, we're going to be fair, and we're going to treat everybody somewhat alike as much as we can.
Well, now in the period from 67 to 76 that you were on the school mm-hmm. board, did you see or do you have any thoughts on how integration proceeded? I mean, by the time you left the school board, some of the students had pretty much not seen anything but integration at that time.
That's right. So, well, it was. I don't think it was much of a problem. Our kids were in school at that time, and they just seemed to get along fine, and I didn't hear of any incidents. You know, there may be a fight at school or something, but it wasn't between a white and a black.
Yeah.
It may be two black boys or two white boys or something like that. It was, I think the school board and the town just decided we're integrated and we're going to do it right. And maybe some other people saw some problems, but I feel like it was very smooth.
Were there other changes that happened about the same time? I mean, you talked about the white water fountains and things like that. Did they begin to go away?
Well, of course, with the Civil Rights Act, you know, blacks could go to restaurants in the front door instead of the back, and that fountain thing was off, and you can sit anywhere you want to in the theater. And yeah, the Civil Rights Act was just a great, it just changed things dramatically.
Okay. Well, in the period of time that you were on the school board the second time, what were the issues that the school board then began to deal with?
Mainly, we were beginning to grow, and mainly was to get a new high school built. And that we accomplished, and there was a little bit of an, well, I'm not sure I even want to bring that up. that was the number one thing is to increase our capability, not building wise and teacher wise, and improve our school system. And also, I'd mention one thing that helped smooth this integration. So is the fact that having the black boys on our athletic teams
mm-hmm.
really made a difference. Mm-hmm. In fact, we had a young, right after we integrated, we had a young man named Michael Daniel who was fast as lightning. And he played halfback on our football team. And I've often said that Michael Daniel smoothed integration in Georgetown more than anybody else because we started winning ball games.
Wow.
And he wasn't the only one. We had a lot of good black athletes that really came through, and the fact that they did, I mean, that was kind of an example for the whole student body. I mean, these kids are heroes, And so let's treat them like heroes. Let's be nice.
Right. I'd like to talk a little bit about the hospital and nurses training program that you were involved in. And so I'd like to go back a little bit. You talked about, you said you bought the hospital with a colleague.
Yeah. Dr. Getty had previously had two partners in the hospital with him, but they moved away.
Okay.
So Dr. Getty and I were basically working together. After I came back from Korea, we worked together. I'd give his anesthetic and he'd give mine, and then we'd give a spinal anesthesia, say for a hysterectomy or an appendectomy. We had a nurse anesthetist who would sit with the patient, but we used spinal anesthesia a lot, and we'd give a spinal, and then the nurse anesthetist would check her blood pressure and keep the IVs going, and Dr. Getty and I would assist each other in our surgery. And then we would alternate, once I bought into the hospital, we would alternate being on call for the emergency room. And at that time, I quit doing home deliveries, except in emergency cases. You know, sometime, doctor, the baby's about here. I don't have time to come to the hospital.
Right.
But I quit home deliveries purposely, because since I was going to take a lick financially by putting them in the hospital just the same as my partner, I was willing to do that. But when he owned the hospital, I didn't want to saddle him with my patients to run up a debt to the hospital.
Okay.
So that was another reason to quit home deliveries, so since I was an owner of the hospital then.
Okay.
But
And your employees in that hospital, they were both white and black?
Yes. At that time, all the nurses were white. Mm-hmm. We had wonderful black ladies in the kitchen, wonderful cooks who...
Yes.
Yeah. And we had a janitor who was black, but none of the nurses were black until we got our nursing school started.
Okay.
See, we had a lot of Swedish nurses at that time who were getting older. And
now, what time was
this?
This
was in the 60s.
Okay.
Early 60s. They were getting older, and we were really wondering, what are we going to do for nurses? So we just happened to, the band director's wife at the high school was an RN who had taught in an LBN school and had some knowledge about how to do it. So Hal and I got together with our chief nurse, who was Ms. Kambach, Mimi Kambach, who still lives around here.
Okay.
She's on the board of the Lone Star Circle of Care now.
Okay.
But anyway, along with her, we got the wife of the band director, and she was named Joyce Jackson, to organize an LVN school. And an LVN school, you had to take classes and you had to work in the hospital and attend lectures and all of that for a full year before you could take the exam to be an LVN.
Okay.
So we started that school. Can we take it? I want to show you.
Okay.
This
the
is
first class
this is the
in
first class of the nursing school, LVN school.
Okay.
In 1961. And as you can see, we had two black girls.
Uh-huh.
One Latin American girl.
Uh-huh.
And this is Dr. Getty, and
okay.
This is me.
Okay.
As you can see, we were a lot younger.
Were any of these regular nurses? I mean, who are the...
This
who
is Joyce Jackson. This
okay.
is the... This is the... She ran the school.
Okay.
This is Miss Golden Munson, who was had been in the hospital way back when the Dr. Martins owned the hospital. She was getting close to retirement.
Okay.
But all of these nurses, and we had graduated a class, I guess, for 10 or 12 years until the Austin Community College took it over.
So your first class was
This was our first one in 61.
61.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the early 70s, Austin Community College began the program.
Mm-hmm. Okay. They took over our program. after we got into the new hospital.
Right.
That was in 78.
Well, now, how did you manage to recruit African Americans and Latinos?
Well, wasn't any problem recruiting them. The problem was us deciding whether or not we were going to let the Latin Americans and the black people participate. You know, we had a lot of discussion between our head nurse and Hal and I about whether or not our patients would accept black nurses. Mm-hmm. And there's some real, I was pretty determined that we ought to do it. And we sent the word out, and they had to have a high school education, and they were interviewed pretty strictly. Boy, Ms. Kalmbach, who was our head nurse after Ms. Golden.
Okay.
Boy, she was a stickler for not only do things right, but she was, if she found out any little moral discrepancy, even on the outside, had nothing to do with the hospital, well, boy, they were in trouble. She was tough, but good.
Well, now, real good. The two African Americans in this picture, was their high school education at the black school here in Georgetown?
Started that way. Let's see, 61. Oh, yes, it was. Had to be.
So they would have graduated from the black school.
These were not Georgetown High School graduates.
They were not?
No, because they were Carver.
Right, the black school.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
That's right.
And they went through the interview process.
Our students just sailed through like crazy. I think we had good teachers, and they were smart girls too. But nearly every graduate of this school worked either in nursing homes or in the hospital, and this is where we got our nurses.
And any problems with having African-American LPNs?
Not the slightest bit. Not the slightest bit. We never had a complaint that I knew of from anybody.
Did you ever hear anything from the black community about the value of the school to them?
Oh, well, I don't heard from them. I think they expressed appreciation for the fact that they were able to go to the school,
and
then they made a good living afterward. And yeah, but nothing. Nothing else, really.
Okay. Well, that's very interesting. Is there anything? I've kind of reached the end of my questions, and we've talked about 45 minutes here. So,
well,
Judy told me last time, now you can stop longer if you want, you know. So, but is there anything else that maybe I've missed that in this period that you thought you would say something about?
Related to...
Really, largely related
integration
to integration or the African-American community as you knew it or anything like that.
No, I don't really think of anything. I think all in all, it was something that had to be done, mm-hmm. And it was a time when you just had to step up and state how you feel and back it up with action, and that's what I feel so proud of the people who started that committee for better schools, because they really stuck their neck out, coming out, even being willing to hire a lawyer to push the integration, even though in that last election for school board, about 65% of the people voted for the segregationists, and they made no bones about the fact that they were running on the segregation ticket. So I think it took some courage on the part of the Committee for Better Schools to come out and against that kind of majority, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, because they thought they were right.
Are any of those people still in Georgetown now?
Yes.
Who?
Norman Spellman, who is a retired professor at Southwestern. The I think, now, Ed Harris was the one that ran the laundry. He was on the committee, but he's moved away.
Okay.
I think George Nelson lives out at Sun City. He was a band director at Southwestern and at our high school years.
Okay.
He's still here. And, of course, I'm here. I wasn't on the committee, but I was supporting them. A Mr. Osborne was real active. He was a voice teacher at Southwestern. His wife, Alice, is still here.
Okay.
But he's dead.
Okay.
I forget, but I believe those are the only ones that are still around.
Well, I want to make sure we see if they're on our list to interview, because that sounds like a group we really would like to know a good deal about.
Yeah.
Well, I thank you for participating in this interview with me.
Well, it's been a pleasure.
I'm going to turn off the tape at this point.